My title is Religious Freedom and the Common Good, Catholic Teaching and Contemporary Challenges. On the day before John Paul II died, April 1st, 2005, then Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger was given the Benedict Award in recognition for his lifelong service to Christian culture. And on the occasion of receiving the award, Ratzinger delivered an address titled On Europe's Crisis of Culture, and he began as follows. We are living in a time of great dangers and great opportunities, a time which is also of great responsibility for us all. During the past century, mankind's possibilities and its dominion over matter grew by truly unthinkable measures. However, his power to dispose of the world has been such as to allow his capacity for destruction to reach dimensions which at times horrify us. Less visible, but no less disquieting, are the possibilities of self-manipulation that mankind has acquired. He has plumbed the depths of being, he has deciphered the components of the human being, and is now capable, so to speak, of constructing man himself, who thus no longer comes into the world as a gift of the Creator, but as a product of our action, a product that therefore can be selected according to the exigencies established by ourselves. Thus the splendor of being an image of God no longer shines over man, which is what confers on him his dignity and inviolability. I begin my remarks on the theme of religious freedom with this citation from Ratzinger because I think it is important for us to recognize that the most fundamental issues and the most difficult challenges of our times turn on the question, what does it mean to be a human being? What is the foundation of human dignity? A foundation of dignity that first justifies and defines human rights. What is freedom? And what is the relationship between freedom and the truth of human nature as created by God and for God? Some of the contemporary debates on religious freedom begin too late in the sense that these anthropological questions are set aside and ignored. It is assumed that when Catholics and contemporary proponents of political liberalism use the term human rights, or for that matter, religion or the church, they mean more or less the same thing. On this reading of the situation, the task for Catholics would be a matter of defending our right to religious freedom within the framework determined by liberalism. But in fact, our current situation is more complex, and it poses a more profound challenge to the full integrity of Christian faith and the dignity of human life. In the long run, it would be a mistake for Catholics to accept uncritically contemporary assumptions about the meaning of human rights and the relationship between freedom and truth. Contemporary liberalism has a radically different understanding of the meaning of freedom. Consider, for example, the well-known words of the United States Supreme Court from the 1994 Casey decision. At the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, and of the universe. The implications of this anthropological vision for our laws and for our common life are extraordinary, although they are difficult to bring to light. One of the hallmarks of liberal political order is the claim to neutrality. The state exists to safeguard and promote human rights, leaving citizens free to decide for themselves substantive questions about the common good. However, it is crucial for Catholics to recognize that this putative neutrality is a fiction. The liberal state both presupposes and increasingly imposes a vision of human freedom as self-grounding autonomy. An alternative understanding of human freedom as informed by natural relations to God and other human beings and as ordered to the truth is excluded from public significance. The result is a tendency to reconceive religious faith and religious practice as irrational and essentially as private opinion. These beliefs can be tolerated up to a point. But when religious belief comes into conflict with another human right, say, for example, reproductive rights, it must give way. A 2012 editorial in the New York Times titled "The Phony Crisis Over Religious Liberty" provides a clear example of the logic of this position. The editors of the Times write, "It was dismaying to see President Obama lend any credence to the misbegotten notion that providing access to contraceptives violated the freedom of any religious institution. Churches are given freedom by the Constitution to preach that birth control is wrong, but they have not been given rights to laws that would deprive their followers or their employees of human rights. If a religious body does not like a public policy that affects its members, it may try to change it, but it cannot claim a special exemption from the law. Faced with this situation, our current situation, I think Catholics need to proceed along two paths simultaneously. First, it is appropriate to pursue legal and political remedies in response to what I think are unjust abrogations of religious freedom, both of individuals and of institutions. We should be grateful for the Beckett Fund and for the many courageous Catholic lawyers and politicians who were working on issues stemming from the HHS contraception mandate and conscientious objection to the Obergefell decision, which redefines marriage. And along this line, recent books by Ryan Anderson and Mary Eberstadt, I think, make an important contribution. But there is a second task that is equally important, although it is perhaps more difficult and less likely to yield immediate practical results. Catholics need to think more deeply, in light of our philosophical and theological tradition, about the meaning of freedom and about the foundation of human rights. And in following this path, we are guided by the teaching set forth in the Second Vatican Council's Declaration on Religious Freedom, Dignitatis Humanae. Although it was approved by an overwhelming majority and commended by Pope Paul VI as one of the greatest documents of the Second Vatican Council, the Declaration on Religious Freedom was the most controversial text of the Council. A significant minority of Council Fathers harbored reservations on the grounds that the text seemed to depart from established Catholic doctrine on the duties of the state toward the Catholic religion. Within the majority that supported an affirmation of religious freedom, there were deep disagreements about the ground of religious freedom and the relationship between freedom and truth. Since the Council, in the last 50 or so years, Dignitatis Humanae has become a cornerstone of the social doctrine of the Catholic Church. According to John Paul II, the Church in our time attaches great importance to all that is stated in the Declaration on Religious Freedom. Religious freedom is at the basis of all other freedoms and is inseparably tied to them all. At the same time, the Declaration has continued to generate controversy and debate. Behind Archbishop Marcel Lefebvre's schismatic act of consecrating four bishops without papal mandate was a conviction that this conciliar text represented a departure from Catholic doctrine and a capitulation to the heresy of modernism. And among supporters of the document, the disagreements that accompanied the drafting of Dignitatis Humanae have served as a fault line for differing accounts of the nature, the foundation, and the scope of the right to religious freedom. Now, there are several reasons why a relatively short document has been the source of such intense controversy and debate. First, as the late Avery Dulles noted, this declaration is the only document of Vatican II that explicitly claims to be a development of doctrine. The aim of the document is to search the sacred tradition and teaching of the Church and to draw forth new things that are in harmony with the old, to develop the teaching of more recent popes on the inviolable dignity of the person. So the question of how to understand the nature of this development and the teaching of Dignitatis Humanae in the context of the Catholic tradition as a whole remains an open question and a difficult question. A second reason why this declaration has generated such interest and debate is the central importance of the question of freedom for the Church's encounter with modernity. According to Ratzinger, the era we call modern times has been determined from the beginning by the theme of freedom, the striving for new forms of freedom. Both Gaudium et Spes and Dignitatis Humanae acknowledge the legitimacy of this aspiration for freedom, because authentic freedom is an exceptional sign of the image of God and man. At the same time, the Council Fathers recognize the need for critical discernment of the modern idea of freedom in light of the truth of human nature and the Christian mystery of redemption in Christ. For John Paul II, the relationship between freedom and truth is the crucial issue of our times. Okay, my plan what follows is to summarize for you the teaching of Dignitatis Humanae, and then to introduce some of the disputed questions that both shaped the drafting of the document and that have determined its interpretation in the Catholic tradition. And then in light of these interpretive issues, I'll return to our current cultural situation and consider the future of religious freedom in the United States. So, part one, the teaching of Dignitatis Humanae. The document's subtitled, On the Right of the Person and Communities to Social and Civil Freedom in Religious Matters. And it consists of two sections preceded by a brief preface. Chapter one presents the general idea of religious freedom and reflects on the foundation and the scope of this right. And chapter two develops the idea of religious freedom in light of Christian revelation, emphasizing especially the freedom of the act of faith and the freedom of the church. The point of departure for a document on religious freedom is, quote, the fact that men and women of our time are becoming more conscious of the dignity of the human person. And increasing numbers demand that in acting they enjoy and make use of their own counsel and a responsible freedom, not impelled by coercion, but moved by a sense of duty. So the aim of the Council Fathers was to discern and deepen this new awareness of human dignity, this desire for freedom, in light of God's revelation. So carefully attending to these desires and proposing to declare to what degree they are in conformity with truth and justice, this Vatican Council searches the sacred tradition and teaching of the Church to draw forth something new from her tradition. To ensure the harmony of new and old, the preface includes an affirmation of the truth of God's revelation in Christ, which has been entrusted to the Church, and that, quote, one true religion subsists in the Catholic and Apostolic Church. All men and women are called to seek this truth and to hold fast to it once it is known. Therefore, the conciliar text leaves intact, integral, the traditional Catholic teaching on the moral duty of individuals and society toward the true religion and the one Church of Christ. These were late additions to the text to allay some of the concerns of Council Fathers that this document was not in harmony with what 19th century popes had set forth. Part one is titled The General Principle of Religious Freedom, and the key text reads as follows. This Vatican Council declares that the human person has a right to religious freedom. Such freedom consists in this, that all men should be immune from coercion on the parts of individuals, social groups, or any human power, so that no one is forced to act against his conscience in religious matters, nor impeded from acting according to his conscience, both in private and in public, whether alone or in association with others, within due limits. This council declares that the right to religious freedom has its foundation in the very dignity of the human person. So that's the initial key affirmation. The declaration proceeds to unfold the meaning and the ground of the right to religious freedom by situating this right in the context of the obligation to seek the truth, especially the truth concerning religion. In order to satisfy this obligation in a way that is in keeping with their nature and dignity, human persons must enjoy psychological freedom as well as immunity from external coercion. It follows that this right to religious freedom persists even for those who do not satisfy their obligation to seek the truth and hold fast to it. The exercise of this right is not to be impeded, provided that just public order is preserved. Secondary arguments to support the right to religious freedom include a reflection on the role of conscience and the social nature of the human person, and the claim that religious acts transcend the earthly and temporal order of things, and accordingly political authority would exceed its limits if it presumed to direct or impede religious acts. On the delicate question of civil recognition of the Catholic Church, or what was sometimes called the establishment of the Catholic religion, the Declaration teaches that if, in light of a people's particular circumstance, special civil recognition is granted to one religious community in the juridical order of the state, it is necessary at the same time that the right to freedom in religious matters be acknowledged and observed for all citizens and religious communities. In order to avoid arbitrary abuses under the pretext of religious freedom, the document introduces the limiting principle of just public order. This concept of just public order includes effective protection for the rights of all citizens, safeguarding public peace, and responsibility for the proper guardianship of public morality. The second chapter is premised on the idea that the Church's teaching on religious freedom has its roots in divine revelation. Although revelation does not expressly affirm the right to immunity from external coercion in religious matters, it does bring to light the dignity of the human person in all its fullness. It manifests the respect Christ showed for the freedom with which man is to fulfill his duty of believing the word of God. The act of faith is of its very nature a voluntary act. And the nature of the act of faith precludes every kind of coercion on the part of man. The fundamental principle for the relationship between the church and civil society is the idea that the church should enjoy as much freedom in acting for the care of man's salvation as necessary. There is then a harmony between religious freedom and the freedom of the church. Okay, in order to appreciate this teaching as a genuine development of doctrine and as a guide for the church's relationship with the modern secular state, it's helpful to know something about the debates that surrounded the drafting of the text. In the words of Ratzinger, the debate on religious liberty will in later years be considered one of the most important events of the council, already rich enough in important events. And there was, in fact, there were two distinct debates, two main debates that accompanied the text. The first debate is perhaps better known. It was characterized by a resolute opposition to the idea of religious freedom, to the idea that the church should be promulgating a document affirming a right to religious freedom, on the grounds that this doctrine represented a departure from what the Catholic Church had taught in the 19th century. The opponents of religious freedom, an articulate and passionate minority that included figures such as Cardinal Ottaviani, prefect of the Holy Office, argued that truth alone has a right to freedom, while error may at best be tolerated. Prior to the start of the council, the theological commission headed by Ottaviani, this is a preparatory commission drafting documents for the council, submitted a text called De Ecclesia that included a chapter on the relationship between the church and state and on religious toleration. And drawing on recent teaching, this draft text says, I quote, "The civil authority also, and not only each citizen, has the duty of accepting the revelation proposed by the church. And the civil authority has the duty to exclude from legislation, government, and public activity everything it would judge to be capable of impeding the church from attaining its eternal end. In short, the right to religious freedom belongs only those adhering to the true religion." So, it's legitimate in the name of the common good to suppress false religions. Now, at the council, a strong majority of fathers deemed this position to be inadequate to the dignity of the person and the meaning of truth in relation to freedom, the nature of political authority in its service to the common good. So, under the direction of Cardinal Bea, the secretary for promoting Christian unity, a new draft was produced for a text on religious freedom. And within the council itself, six distinct drafts of this text were discussed by the council fathers. And during this discussion, a really fascinating debate emerged between two main groups that we can somewhat simplistically, but it's a helpful label, called the American School and the French School. And this division has continued to function as a sort of fault line in the reception of Dignitatis Humanae. The American bishops and theological advisors, championed by the Jesuit priest John Courtney Murray, approached the issue of religious freedom as a formally juridical or constitutional concept. The two key principles underlying Murray's approach are, first, a negative understanding of freedom as immunity from coercion, and second, the total incompetence of the state in regard to religious matters. By contrast, the French school, which included Carol Wojtyła, sought to ground the right to religious freedom in the duty of the human person to seek the truth about God, a duty rooted in man's nature. The French school also affirmed the state's responsibility for the common good, and therein a responsibility to recognize and favor the religious life of its citizens. Okay, so to better understand the difference between these two schools, it's helpful to consider their answers to three interrelated questions. What is the first meaning of freedom? That's the first question. Second, what is the importance of truth within the political order? And then finally, what is the nature and end of political authority? Regarding the first, as I said, the American school tended to conceive freedom primarily in negative terms, as immunity from coercion. The first meaning of freedom is autonomy, the exigence to act on one's own initiative. The French position, by contrast, emphasized that freedom exists within a natural order of relations. Freedom itself is ordered to the truth. Coincident with a right to immunity is a responsibility to seek the truth about God. Freedom is essentially relational. Second, regarding the question of truth, both schools emphasize that human beings have a moral obligation to a transcendent order of truth. But according to the approach favored by the American bishops and theologians of the council, the question of truth has no relevance within the political order. Thus, Murray writes, "Man is responsible for the conformity between the inner imperatives of his conscience and the transcendent order of truth. However, on the horizontal plane of intersubjective relationships and within the social order, which is the order within which human rights are predicated, man's fulfillment of this responsibility is juridically irrelevant." Pietro Pavan echoes this in saying, "Religious freedom does not concern the relationship of the human person to truth." The French position, by contrast, grounds the right to religious freedom in the human person's obligation to seek the truth. Particularly noteworthy here is a crucial intervention by Bishop Ancel during the fourth and final session of the Second Vatican Council. He was speaking on behalf of 100 French bishops, and he said, "The connection that exists between the obligation to seek the truth and religious freedom has not been made clear. It has been said that man has an obligation to seek the truth. It has likewise been said that freedom presents no objection to this. But unless I'm mistaken, the positive connection between these two has not been made clear. I would like to put forward this ontological foundation and therefore show the connection that exists between the obligation to seek the objective truth and religious freedom itself. My position is as follows. The ontological foundation of religious freedom, as set forth in our text, is the very obligation to seek the truth. For in fact, every man, because he is a human being, that is endowed with reason and free will, is bound to seek the objective truth and to hold fast to it, to order his whole life according to its demands. Because this principle has its foundation not in any subjective disposition, but in the very nature of man, it has a strictly universal validity." The historian Gilles Routier notes that this intervention by Ancel made a very deep impression on Paul VI, and he insisted that Ancel be appointed to the committee that was drafting the text. And also Wojtyła was struck by Ancel's intervention, and during the council debate, supported him with a concise statement, without truth, there's no freedom. Without truth, there's no freedom. Okay, the third question concerns the nature and end of political authority. Again, John Courtney Murray's approach turns on the idea that the state is totally incompetent in religious matters. During the conciliar debate, this issue is often framed in terms of the criteria by which a government might legitimately limit the right to religious freedom. Murray said that the appropriate limiting principle is public order. He says, public order, in contrast to the common good, embraces only those values necessary for sheer coexistence of citizenry. The French position, by contrast, sought to reintroduce the idea of the common good as the purpose of political authority. Insofar as man, by virtue of his natural relation to God, is ordered to seek the truth, the putative neutrality of the state vis-a-vis truth is a fiction. The state should be open to a transcendent order by acknowledging and favoring the religious life of its citizens. Okay, so it's beyond the scope here tonight to go through how the final revisions to the text reflect this debate, but I think it's fair to say that the latest changes shifted the text fairly decisively in the direction of the French school. But this situation is complicated by the fact that, especially in the United States, the dominant reception and interpretation of the text tended to emphasize the line of argument developed by John Courtney Murray. In the widely read Abbott edition of the Documents of Vatican II, Murray wrote an introduction to the text of Dignitatis Humanae, he translated the text of Dignitatis Humanae, and he provided an extensive commentary in a series of annotations. And in general, he tended to ignore or downplay the key revisions to the text that were introduced as a result of the interventions of Ancel and Wojtyla and other council fathers concerned with an objective order of truth and a common good. Murray did express dissatisfaction with the final version of Dignitatis Humanae. He especially objected to what he called the prominence given to man's moral obligation to seek the truth as somehow the foundation of the right to religious freedom. He argues that the duty to seek the truth does not deserve a place in the structure of a demonstration of the right to religious freedom. Why? It fails to yield the crucial political conclusion that governments should not hinder individuals or religious communities from public worship. For example, he says, think of a Catholic government or a communist government. These are Murray's examples. These governments need not concern themselves with man's duty to seek the truth. They can simply maintain that they already have the truth, that they are entitled, in fact, it is their duty to repress public manifestations of error. There's a crucial presupposition in Murray's line of argument that needs to be brought to light and I think challenged. And the presupposition is that truth is essentially unfree or indifferent to freedom. This is why a Catholic state in possession of the truth would no longer be concerned with the freedom of its citizens. At the same time, political freedom is then conceived in purely formal or instrumental terms. It may be the case that freedom allows one to arrive at the terminus of truth, but in itself, freedom has nothing to do with truth. Freedom is simply autonomy, the capacity to act on one's own initiative. Now here's where we can see that both John Paul II and Joseph Ratzinger have developed an alternative account of the meaning of freedom and the relationship between freedom and truth. Already during the council, the relationship between freedom and truth emerged as a chief concern of Bishop Wojtyla. There is no freedom without truth. And this unity also became a key theme in his pontificate. In Veritatis Splendor, he criticizes currents of thought which tend to dissolve the essential bond between freedom and truth. And helping to rediscover this bond represents one of the specific requirements of the Church's mission. Freedom, he says, is never freedom from the truth, always freedom in the truth. The right to religious freedom is an inner requirement of the human person's responsibility for the truth. Reciprocally, the truth itself and the claim that the truth makes calls for a free and personal adherence. Interpreting and developing this insight of John Paul II, Joseph Ratzinger criticizes the modern tendency to conceive freedom as an autonomous, self-grounding power to choose. He says, on the contrary, freedom means membership, being at home, participation in being itself. Freedom, he says, is identical with ontological dignity, which of course only makes sense if ontological dignity is really dignified, the gift of love and being given in love. This is a great insight. Freedom is the gift of love and being given in love. For Ratzinger, the circumcision of freedom and truth has its deepest roots in the mystery of God's being love. God himself is a communion, an eternal exchange of life and love. Being created in the image of a Trinitarian God means that the human person is essentially or constitutively relational. Ratzinger likes to cite the words of Augustine. What is so much yours as yourself? What is so little yours as yourself? The innermost core of our personal identity, our I, the sanctuary of our freedom, is itself a gift from another and for another. The original structure and the final perfection of human freedom is communion. According to both John Paul II and Ratzinger, this relational anthropology is fully revealed in the mystery of Christ, whose being and mission are summed up by the word son. To be a son, Ratzinger says, is to be in relation. It involves giving up the autonomy that is closed in on itself. At the same time, both thinkers argue that the evidence for this relational anthropology is also available to reason, especially a philosophical reason that is open to faith. The astonishing existence of a child who exists for its own sake as an undeserved gift, yet in utter dependence upon others, discloses the nature of human freedom and its inviolable dignity and original openness to God. Human freedom is essentially a gift that is structurally receptive. Repeating Wojtyla's claim that there is no freedom without truth, Pope Benedict agrees and adds the claim, there is no truth without freedom. The truth cannot unfold except in an otherness open to God. Hence, it is not fitting to say in an exhaustive way, I possess the truth. The truth is not possessed by anyone. It is always a gift which calls us to undertake a journey of ever closer assimilation to truth. Truth can only be known and experienced in freedom. For this reason, we cannot impose the truth on others. Truth is disclosed only in an encounter of love. For both thinkers, the Council's teaching on religious freedom is not, in the first place, a juridical or constitutional proposal. It is first a teaching on the transcendent dignity of the human person, who is created in love and called to seek the truth and live in communion with the truth. Okay, why is it important for us to recover the anthropological vision underlying Dignitatis Humanae? How does this bear on some of the questions we're facing today? You might say, why would it be a mistake to conceive the question of religious freedom as primarily juridical or constitutional? The juridical approach developed by John Courtney Murray might seem to allow the Church to make peace with modern liberal institutions while granting her the freedom to resist the problematic aspects of liberal ideology. The difficulty here is that these institutions of our culture, the laws also of these institutions, are not neutral with respect to the meaning of the human being and the meaning of human freedom. They presuppose a vision of the human person in relation to God, as well as a metaphysical account of the relationship between freedom and truth. It's not enough for the Church simply to request a sphere where we can still hold on to our private beliefs and quaint practices. In the long run, this would be to reject the Catholic claim to truth. The defense of religious freedom stands or falls with the truth of the human being, created in the image of God and made for communion. And here we can recall the prophetic words of Ratzinger cited at the outset. Having deciphered the components of the human being, man is capable, so to speak, of constructing man himself, who thus no longer comes into the world as a gift of the Creator. During more recent years, the project of taking control of and directing human conception and birth has continued to gather momentum. In our time, the Church's defense of religious freedom involves defending the truth about human conception and the gift of new life. Why? Why is this important for religious freedom? The family is a school of freedom. It's precisely within the family that the human being learns the meaning of his existence as a gift and learns what it means to love and be loved by others. Ratzinger says, and he wrote this many, many years ago in the late 60s, I quote, "The family is the primordial cell of freedom. As long as it survives, a minimal sphere of freedom is secured. For this reason, dictatorships will always aim at breaking up families in order to eliminate this sphere of freedom that is exempt from their control." And here it's worthwhile thinking, and hopefully we can discuss this together. Why have so many of these questions about the Church today and our Christian faith today, why do they so often turn on questions about freedom in relation to human conception, birth, marriage, human death? It's interesting. Why is this such a flashpoint? And here, a great insight of John Paul II was these issues, especially the conception and birth of a child, these aren't simply moral issues, but they're ontological. It reveals something about the truth of human life as a gift from God, and therefore defending the full integrity of human nature and the dignity of human life from conception all the way till natural death is a defense of freedom. Okay, let me conclude. In a letter that he wrote in December of 1959, before the council, when all the bishops around the world were asked to write about the agenda for the upcoming council, the very young auxiliary bishop of Krakow expressed a hope that the upcoming council would focus its attention on the mystery of the human person as created in the image of God. The crucial issue of our time, what he was suggested, is the human person, a unique being who participates in the material cosmos, but who has intense spiritual longings, a being who is destined to participate by grace in the very life of the Trinity. According to Wojtyla, not only the faithful, but the world want to hear from the upcoming council what the Church has to say about the human person, about the distinctiveness of Christian humanism. This request found a surpassing answer in the theological vision of the council, especially as outlined in Gaudium et Spes and the Declaration on Religious Freedom. The Council Fathers noted a new sense of the dignity of the human person that calls for a new respect for religious freedom. No one is to be forced to act against his conscience, nor impeded from acting according to his conscience, in public and private. This solemn declaration of an ecumenical council was the fruit of a great debate on religious freedom. From the beginning of the council all through six drafts of a text, the declaration faced steep challenges and objections. As a result of this debate, the document was significantly deepened. Perhaps the most important revision concerns the relationship between freedom and truth. The ontological foundation of religious freedom is the very obligation to seek truth. The great achievement of Dignitatis Humanae is to affirm and uphold the transcendent dignity of the human person, who is created in love and called to seek the truth and live in communion with the truth. Thank you.